Okay, I would like to welcome all of you to this special presentation on the deep national security state and UFOs. And this is going to be a presentation 4 hours in length. We will take a break at about the halfway point, maybe about an hour and 45 minutes in, 2 hours. And I'd like to just thank all of you for coming. I know you've been from all over the country here, people here from Chicago, New York, all over, and I want to express my appreciation for your support and effort in coming all that way to be here. I'd also like to welcome all the folks online. There are several thousand people online who will be seeing this by webinar, and I'd like to extend a welcome to them and a big shout out to them for coming. Thank you. You're here in virtual reality, huh? Yeah, why not? So I'm Dr. Stephen Greer, and the founder of the Disclosure Project and the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence and the Orion Project. Those are all now sort of amalgamated under SiriusDisclosure.com if you want to go and see what all the projects are doing at any time. And we're going to be doing this presentation, which is going to be part of a series. I really want to thank the people who've supported me all these years in getting this far. There's some folks who are volunteers out front who've been on many expeditions with me out under the stars, and people all over the world. My mentors in the national security state, who without them I would have never had a Sherpa to figure out how this whole system works. You're going to learn things tonight, today, that the President of the United States doesn't know. I will assure you of that. I will give you my assurance that it's true. It is also true that without some very special person, and her name is Emily, my wife of 36 years, we wouldn't be here. So a big thank you to Emily. She set this up. And really and truly, if Emily had not supported me all these years, there aren't many Jewish doctors, daughters, wives, who will be happy with their husband leaving a career in emergency medicine to be doing this for virtually nothing for 25 years. And that's when we started this project 25 years ago. So she's an amazing person, and without her, we would have never, ever gotten this far. She's really been the indispensable person that nobody knows about, and I want to acknowledge her. So thank you, Emily. Love you. So the other thing I'd like to do, as we just some housekeeping things, again, no cell phones, please. And if there are any children who are on the webinar, I know this sounds strange. We're going to go through some things that are disturbing, and I would say parental discretion is advised for that reason. I usually would not say that, but we are today, and I need to say it. And the first thing I want to go through is sort of an architecture of what the deep national security state is. Because this is something that when I started out in 1990, I didn't think could possibly be true. And in fact, when I was meeting with the French government officials a few years ago here in Washington and then out at our farm in Virginia, I got a phone call from an Air Force intelligence guy and a liaison to the French president at that time, Nicolas Sarkozy, who said, "This is fantastic and terrible." And he didn't know if he quite believed it. And I said, "Well, come to Washington and I'll let you meet with some folks who are in the deep national security state who will confirm everything I'm about to tell you." So they came to Washington and we had a meeting, and I began to explain to them that there are two governments. There's the government of we the people that Thomas Jefferson spoke of, that we have elected, and those who have been appointed. And since World War II, there has evolved a monster, which you're going to hear about, which desperately needs to be put on a leash and eventually phased out. And that is the deep national security state of unacknowledged special access projects. Now, this is a term most people are not familiar with. Almost most of you, if you're anyone here from D.C., raise your hand if you're a D.C. person. You probably have heard of TSSCI, Top Secret Special Compartmented Intelligence. A top secret clearance are like 985,000 people who have them. It's you know, that and $1.50 will get you on the metro. So those are not unusual. What's unusual are the projects I'm about to talk to you about. And these unacknowledged special access projects are projects that have not been supervised by the president or the Congress in an appropriate way since 1956, at least 1956. And this is a key date for you to keep in mind. I was 1 year old, so I couldn't do anything about that. Most of us here weren't of an age where we could have done anything about that disaster. But we're going to talk about how that evolved and how an unacknowledged special access project really operates. The very first thing you need to understand is that it developed as a consequence of the extraordinary secrecy around the UFO issue. And if you doubt it, it goes all the way back to 1945. And I'm going to go through some documents. The one that's up here is one that we acquired and released. It's now the number one viewed document on the FBI site, this one. But before I get to that, I want to talk about what happened in the 1940s, in World War II. So most of you know we had President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and there were events going on in Europe and also in the Pacific, but mainly in Europe, where there were these things called Foo Fighters. Yes, it's a rock group. And Dave Grohl, it's a great guy, he named his band after what I'm about to tell you. But a Foo Fighter, aside from being a really fun rock band, were objects that were flying around our aircraft in World War II. Sometimes they were fully materialized, hard. Most of the time, they were an energy field that looked spherical. And they could come through an aircraft, even coming down the center of an aircraft and out the other end. This is the trans-dimensional nature of extraterrestrial technologies that I covered in a previous workshop. This became a huge concern for the Allies. And the Allies dispatched, or the president, I should say, on behalf of the Allies, dispatched a man named General Jimmy Doolittle. Now, how do I know this? Because his nephew is a dear friend of mine, Dr. John Altshuler. Dr. Altshuler is a hematologist, oncologist in Denver, very renowned. And he was asked, General Doolittle was asked to go over to the theater of operations in Europe to find out what the hell these things were. Now, the word Foo Fighters come from sort of French and German faux for fire, because they were these fiery, had a luminous corona around them. And but they would disrupt electromagnetic signals. They would have effects on the gravity around an aircraft and other things such as guidance systems, compasses, and what have you. And so we thought, the Americans and British thought, it was a secret Nazi weapon. And we found out through our spies that the Germans thought it was a secret Allied weapon. And of course, it was neither. So General Doolittle went over and investigated this and came back to the White House and reported back to President Roosevelt and said, "Sir, these are interplanetary vehicles," I'm quoting. And so began the modern era of a serious concern from the national security level about UFOs. You can argue it went back to the airship scare of late 1890s, where there were massive crafts seen off the coast of California, but there wasn't that much official concern at that point. It was sort of an enigma. But in World War II, because of the type of weapons being developed, both by Hitler and by America, the interstellars, as I call them, became very concerned about what humans were doing on Earth and the risk of us destroying this planet, which I believe, in carefully in analyzing the history of this, that they have a interest in its survival and humanity's survival. And so the president at that point did assemble a group of folks that included Oppenheimer, people who worked on the Manhattan Project, Dr. Vannevar Bush, no relationship to President Bush, and others to look into the issue. By the time we detonated the first atomic bomb, the facilities at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico and Alamogordo, that area, were being overflown regularly by UFOs. And they were very concerned, obviously, that we were developing weapons that could terminate life on the planet. And they could see where this was headed. So this was not something that just happened out of the blue. There's a history here you must understand. In the early days, and I'm talking now from the early mid-1940s until 1956, there was a reasonable level of constitutional oversight by key members of Congress, senior people in the administrations, and the President of the United States. Everything changed in 1956. Now, when we had the only nuclear, and actually technically it's an atomic bomb squadron and not a thermonuclear one that was developed later. Everybody know the difference between atomic and thermonuclear? Atomic bomb is fission, nuclear is fusion, hydrogen. Anyway, the atomic bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was developed, as you all know, in New Mexico, and was tested at White Sands, and eventually in Roswell, New Mexico, that was the only bomber squadron that had atomic bombs in the world for a number of years before the Soviet Union developed them. And in 1947, there were two or three, I have intelligence recently that indicates there were three so-called flying saucers, discs, flying by and doing surveillance of the 509th Bomber Squadron, which was the only atomic bomb squadron in the world. And they switched on, suddenly, an alleged radar system. Read this document carefully. Now, this, I know it's hard for you to see the original. It's dated 1950. It was to J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover building's right near here. And an Air Force source stated that there were three flying saucers recovered in New Mexico. They're described as circular in shape with raised centers, 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape, but only 3 feet tall. They're actually about 39 inches tall. In metallic cloth, very fine texture, etc. And it says that the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it's believed the radar interferes with the controlling mechanism of the saucers. This is a little bit anthropocentric and childish, because if you can go interstellar, you can handle a radar system. What actually happened is that those radar domes had a scalar longitudinal electromagnetic weapon, which is another whole classification of electromagnetic warfare systems that we'll get into later. But suffice it to say, it was an early scalar Star Wars hit. And when they switched that on, at least two of these discs collided. One went down northwest of Roswell. The other one continued and was more intact and was impacted near Socorro, New Mexico. And that's where they actually retrieved the bodies. The ones that was just north of Roswell was obliterated into little teeny pieces, tiny little pieces. Where they did retrieve, and we have Disclosure Project witnesses who have testified to this, who have personally seen what looks like almost hieroglyphic writing on some of the little parts that were retrieved. And I know I've seen these, and it's very interesting because it's reminiscent of the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, but not quite the same. Makes you wonder where the pyramids came from. So that event was an early hit. Now, there are some reports of others, but that's the most documented one. This document from the FBI is significant because, obviously, 3 years later, you had one branch of the government trying to find out what the other top secret branch of the government was doing. You can tell by the tone of it. I made inquiries through here and there. So it's a bunch of skullduggery that happens between agencies and competition. And there's always been competition between FBI, CIA, Air Force Intelligence, et cetera, and so on. And this happens not just with the United States. It also happens between allies and alliances. For example, the next document, if you can pull this up, this is one of the most important documents. And by the way, after I briefed the CIA director about all this stuff, the sitting CIA director for President Clinton, which we'll get into in a moment, I got a cache of several thousand of these documents, about 5,000 of them. And they're in my vault. I don't know what to do with them. If we presented what was in them, it would take us from now until 2017. But let me just say that this document was accidentally released by the Canadian government, and if you look at the date on it, 1950, November 21st. How ironic. This is the 65th anniversary of the writing of this document by Wilbur Smith, who had a top secret clearance, and he was tasked by the Canadian government to find out what the Americans were doing. And if you look at page 2, if you go down to page 2 of this, you're going to see just a brief summary, which I think is, there's a whole lot of detail in the document. This is on our website now. You can look it up. Many of you may have seen this one already, but the reason I want to present it is the importance of the document. And it says, the matter is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher than the H-bomb. Think about that. The H-bomb wasn't detonated until 1952. It was the ultimate doomsday weapon. This project dealing with UFOs and interstellar technologies was more highly classified than the H-bomb. Period. B. Flying saucers exist. Period. Their modus operandi is unknown, but a concentrated effort is being made by a small group of headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who also worked with Edward Teller, Oppenheimer, and others. And 4, the entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. I have a whole dossier that a Canadian put together of the Wilbur Smith investigations on behalf of the Canadian government to find out what in the hell the Americans were doing with these extraterrestrial vehicles. It's a fascinating case. Now, the reason this is so important is that it acknowledges several things, that they exist, that it's the most secret issue in the U.S. government, exceeding the secrecy of the H-bomb, and that a group had been put together to study how they operate. Well, they were studying materiel recovered from one or more interstellar crashes that were the result of using these scalar longitudinal electromagnetic systems, which Tesla had worked on and others had worked on in the early part of the 20th century. Keep in mind that by the early 1900s, there had been experiments done on not only scalar and electromagnetics, that longitudinal systems, which are, just to put it in a simple layman's term, the light in this room that we're looking at, it has a wave function and a particle function. It goes 186,000 miles a second. A scalar longitudinal system is, there's no wave. It's boom, and it's a point, and it's multiples of the speed of light. And so once you understand how these operate, and I have folks at the Naval Research Labs here in Washington who have done communication systems developed based on pulsed scalar systems that are multiple of the speed of light. So if you think that you cannot communicate faster than the speed of light, you are wrong. And the physicists are wrong. It's because they don't know about the scalar end of this, but that's a no, because that's all classified. They're not going to teach you that at MIT or Caltech. So these systems have been developed and have been deployed since at least the mid-1940s, which is a frightening thought because it's an area of technology that is potentially devastating if it's in the wrong hands. And unfortunately, it fell into the wrong hands, and there it remains. So one of the things that happened along the lines around this time, the next document, a very important one, look at the release date. A few months after I briefed the CIA director. So after I met with him, I said, look, I'm going to give you a list of stuff I want to see if I can get. I got this massive box. Came out to my farm in Virginia. And this is one of them, and there are others. And it's from 1953, although you can't see the date on it very well here. It's written by the director of the CIA to the director of Psychological Strategy Board. Psychological Strategy Board? What? Psychological warfare. And it says, you can read it, I'm transmitting to the National Security Council a proposal, tab BA, which we don't have, which is concluded that the problems connected to UFOs appear to have implications for psychological warfare as well as for intelligence and operations. And then there's another tab, B, which has the background. I'd love to see that one. I suggest that we discuss in an early board meeting the possible offensive or defensive utilization of these phenomena for psychological warfare purposes. Remember this document 4 hours from now. Because basically what they concluded was they needed to do a few things. They wanted to be able to set up a deception around the subject and put out false information, use it as a cover story for classified aerospace research. So oftentimes there will be something that happens and it will look like a UFO, and it's actually a Northrop Grumman. My uncle's company was Northrop Grumman. He worked on the thing that landed on the moon, the lunar module. Or Lockheed Martin Skunk Works or some other aerospace entity, and it will be 100% man-made, and the public will say, oh my God, it's a UFO. And they'll not correct them. There's no correction forthcoming. They want you to believe it's a UFO. Why? Because it provides a cover for classified research with technologies that, if they were allowed to come out, would terminate the oil and gas and coal industry. They're using zero-point energy and gravity control. Which then brings me to the next issue. And that is, by 1954, October, so now we're 61 years plus 1 month, into an era, and this was confirmed to me by the third highest ranking official at the Naval Research Labs and the highest ranking scientist, in other words, someone who wasn't a bureaucrat at the Naval Research Labs, which Thomas Edison founded, and the Naval Research Labs is the largest defense lab in the United States. And Richard Foch, and I knew him for many years before he passed away of prostate cancer not too long ago, was this gentleman. I've never wanted to discuss who he was until he passed away. And he was a very senior guy in this system. And one of the things that he shared is that he was in the vault, the same vault that the next document came out of, which has a great story behind it. And he was going through some documentation and found that it wasn't in the 50s that we really started, I mean the 60s or 70s, but it was in the 50s that we actually mastered gravity control. Now what does that mean? Gravity control is the ability to put an electromagnetic field at certain voltages and with certain angular momentum. I don't want to get into a lot of, put you to sleep, I got into the physics of it too far, so that this object becomes massless, weightless, no mass, M-A-S-S. So the mass component, and this has to do with angular momentum and things of this sort of the subatomic particles, can make this object so light that it has no mass, which means if you look at your physics equations, mass, velocity is inversely proportional to mass. Go look it up. So if mass becomes zero, velocity can go to infinity in a given amount of energy, which means you can move into another dimension. It doesn't go to infinity. You go trans-dimensional. We'll talk about this some more later. And this began to be experimented with in the 1920s. A guy named T. Townsend Brown developed a system using crystalline structures and very high voltages going into an object so that an object would begin to levitate. Marcel Vogel, one of the chief engineer scientists for IBM in North Carolina on the Reynolds estate, did the same thing in the 60s and 70s. One of the members of my team and one of our disclosure project witnesses worked with Marcel Vogel doing this with crystalline structures. And it can be crystals, but it can also be nanocrystalline materials such as metallic. So, as you know, most metals and rocks are crystal. Actually, water is crystalline. We're crystalline. So you can put this system around almost anything, and it will begin to become increasingly massless. Now, it doesn't have to be zero mass. Maybe it's 0.1 mass. So it's still materialized, and you see it. But it means, man, can you accelerate this thing? So it means you can, instead of going like the space shuttle at 25,000 miles an hour, you can go at several million miles per hour and take a right turn. And there's no deceleration effect because everyone on board is corrected for 1G. So this is what they began, 1G gravitational force. So this is what began to develop in the 20s, got taken into some Army Air Force projects in the 30s and 40s, and was Adolf Hitler's secret weapon. Adolf Hitler, they weren't making the progress on the atomic bomb that we were, but they had almost perfected gravity control by the time World War II ended. Now, one of the things that the OSS did, the Office of the Special Services, which became the CIA after World War II, they had something, you can look this up, called Operation Paperclip. And Operation Paperclip, a whole book was written on it not too long ago, about how they would put a paperclip on the file of the Nazis that we didn't want to go to Nuremberg and execute, but that whose knowledge was so great that we wanted them as part of our program. We wanted what they knew. So one of these guys is a guy named Wernher von Braun, who, of course, invented the rocket, the V-2 rocket for Adolf Hitler. Hermann Oberth. These were all the giants of rocketry and aerospace for Adolf Hitler. They became the foundation of, brought in by the CIA, what became the CIA, of our space program in the 1940s and 50s, which is how we leapt ahead of the Soviet Union, because we took all those people first, ahead of the Soviet Union. Interesting bit of history. You don't read this many places. But a lot of what I'm telling you is in conventional history books, not the UFO part. That's been sanitized out. That's forbidden knowledge. So as a result, by the time we had those guys and the experimentation that had been done by T. Townsend Brown, whose work became a part of a corporation called the RAND Corporation, which still exists, a huge think tank, we really had something going. You add to this the study of materiel and electronics retrieved from interstellar vehicles that were shot down. So a lot of people say, oh, well, the things we have, are they all just reverse engineered from interstellar ET? I said, no. The laws of the universe are universal, and the mind of man, just like the man of an ET, can unravel the mysteries of the universe. And so it has come to pass. But if you take, we're not starting at zero when we retrieve the objects that were interstellar. We were starting with decades of research in classified electronics, electromagnetic fields, anti-gravity, scalar systems, et cetera, and so on, that had been going on since the time of Nikola Tesla, the true genius of the 20th century, not Albert Einstein, by the way. So, who is a minor luminary compared to Tesla. And Sorry, Einstein fans. It's true. By the way, that's why when Nikola Tesla died, the FBI swooped into his apartment and confiscated all of his secret papers. And how do I know this? I have a doctor.